Today is Wednesday, August 27th, 1997, and this is Tom Puglia, and I am interviewing Charles Risinga II. And what we're going to start with, he's going to tell us a little bit about some research that he's done. He has a book, in fact, on his family history, and he has followed his ancestry quite a ways back. So he's going to kind of tell us a story of the beginning of the name and his first ancestors.
Tom, it was interesting. When I wrote this book, it was published in 1995, but it took me a couple years to write this by hand, and I did this when I was in the South in the winter. But to accumulate and get this information, I was in the Netherlands and found a relative who was my father's first cousin's son, who had been in genealogy, and he was interested. And so I picked up some of this information through him. And his name was Hans Risinga. And the information, we went to the small town of Reisum, Germany, which is just across the lake from Groningen, which is in the Netherlands, and this is part of Germany. And we went there for the day to check out this little town, which had between 500 and 700 people. And in the hundreds of years, it never grew hardly at all, because it seemingly the young people left this said little town and moved over in other parts of the big cities, or they moved over to the Netherlands. And this happened in the 1700s, that young men from Germany went over to Holland, or the Netherlands, and settled there and married these Dutch girls. And it was traditional in those days to come up with the name Hayes Harms. That was, each generation changed. The second generation would be Harm Hayes. The third generation would be Hayes Harms. So this went on until Napoleon conquered that part of the world. And because of the confusion it was in keeping track of these Dutch people, he said, you must have a surname. So he came up and said, you must have, by such and such a time, each have a surname. And so they want to honor their the first generation that came over to the Netherlands, and whose name was Hayes Harm. But he came from the little town of Reisum, Germany, which is spelled R-Y-S-U-M. And I went there and saw just, it was interesting, because the more I dug into this, I found out that to honor this first generation that came over, they would like to call it after the name of Risum. But in Dutch, in those days and today too, a GA is from a place, like it was from the Netherlands, so, or from, I should say, from Germany. So they said Risinga, GA. They added that to it. But the interesting thing is, in the picture I have in the book, it's R-Y-S-U-M, but in the Dutch language, it is, they don't have a Y in their alphabet, and so they spelled it with an R-I-J-Z-E-N-G-A, and it seems a lot different than the way it's spelled today. But that's how the name come about, and it was done in 1812, and we documented that in the book to show when the name was changed. This friend of mine, or this relative, Hans Risinga, and I, while we were traveling there, we saw market, and the market was Casimir Market, and it was very interesting because in Grand Haven we had a number of Casimir families that had meat markets, and so we got a fish sandwich. I set the camera up, and in the background, it shows Casimir's market. And it was just a nice coincidence that happened that way. And that the other thing that we saw in Reisen, Germany, when we went there, was a church. There was only one church in the whole community. And I was struck by the denomination, because you're thinking in Germany there's a lot of Lutherans, and there are a lot of Catholics too. But this happened to be a Reformed church, was built from 200 to 300 years before. It had been remodeled, fixed up, and there in the churchyard was a cemetery, and you could see there were old stones from way back. There was a woman who was the caretaker of it. She lived across the street, and we found out by a bystander who where she lived, and he says, if you go over there, I think she'll show you the church. Well, my relative can speak both German and English and Dutch, so he went to the door, and the woman came out with a white apron, and she was so pleasant. She says, yes, I'll be happy to show it. And so she had the big key and opened the church, and it was just to spick and span and clean, and the church is still being used today. And after she showed us around, in her humble way, she brought us back to her house, and it was a room that had a lot of antiques in it, and the ceiling was just about 6 foot 6 high, and had a fireplace in it and lamps, and she had to treat us to a cup of tea and some of her freshly made cookies. So that was the way we were taken care of it at this church, and it was a great experience. Then we traveled over to other parts of the Netherlands, and in the Groningen is the province, and in this province you have cities where my grandmother was. Her name was Wiersma, and she came to America, and my grandfather and she were married at the age of 21 years of age. They lived in Muskegon.
But was your grandfather already here, or was did
my grandfather came here from the Netherlands?
Okay.
And he was about, I think he's 20 years old. He was born in 1854, and then after he was here a year or so, then she came over. So they must have been friends over in the Netherlands. And Uithuizen Maiden was the town that my grandfather was baptized in, the church in this area. And I took a picture of this church, and it's still standing today. And there aren't many churches that are a couple hundred years old that are still standing without a lot of remodeling. But this had not been in. Looked just like it. They says it did when it was first built. I have this these documents here of the birth certificate of my great grandfather, whose name was Peter Reisinger. And they spelled it P-I-E-T-E-R, and in this in our country we spell it with P-E-T-E-R. And the interesting thing is when we're talking about this Y in the German language, Reisen, but the Dutch, did they mention it?
Yes. Yeah.
So they still, and it's an IJ, just like you would read it off in Myers Market, spelt the same way, M-E-I-J-E-R. And coincidental, this was told to me some years ago that Hendrik Myers, who started the Myers Market, had a son, Fred. And Fred was a young man who thought he could modernize, and he was very progressive, and so he thought he could change the name to M-E-Y-E-R, Americanize it, and the father says, Fred, this is not going to be so. This is a Dutch market, and we're going to spell it the way it's supposed to be spelled. So then they were changed back to what you see today.
Oh. Was there a certain reason or objective that you were trying to fill by writing your book?
Well, I had read in some magazine where they said that very few people could, 80% as a matter of fact, couldn't name their great-grandfather's first name. So just in the office, to have friends or people come up, I would ask them, and it was surprising. It was true. They didn't know their great-grandfather's first name. And so I thought, well, if we're going to pass on something, maybe we ought to give them a little of the background history of how we got here and who we came from and where we came from and how we accomplished some of the goals that are laid out in the book. So I feel that that's where the starting point was, and then the work began, and how we got into the lumber business.
One thing before we go there with that, because I want to get into that, but how did, you said your parents probably knew each other in the old country, and then they came to Grand Rapids, did you say?
My grandparents came to Muskegon.
Okay.
And he worked on ships that carried lumber from Muskegon to Chicago or through the Great Lakes.
Okay.
But he met this Emke Wiersma. And the Wiersma, she was a year younger, and I think he was 21 and she was 20 years old when they married. Then they lived in Muskegon and raised five children, or four. And then they moved south, and that was in Spring Lake Township. And the interesting part is that after living in Muskegon, he did own some property. It was apartments, a couple rental property, where he was a good businessman. But he moved into Spring Lake Township along the railroad track, where today we have a factory. Risingo Homes is located on the land where my father was born, and International Aid is part of that property as well. And so it's here. Many years ago, I just felt that I'd like to acquire that land for sentimental reasons. So when I started, it was one price, and by the time 10 years later, it just about tripled in value. But anyway, that's where we first started our Rising the Homes in Grand Haven, and then moved and put up a new building on the property where my father was born and raised, and went to school, to the DeWitt School. Then there was another school on 168th, which is in far from the farmhouse, but they walked back and forth through the snow. And my grandfather raised fruit. And I sometimes wonder how he did so well, but he had about 80 acres of land. And I had found through the title property of what it cost him at that time to buy that land and what he paid in interest, and the interest was like 9%, so it was high in those days. Anyway, this property we look at now is a real valuable property, but that wasn't the start of our business. I should maybe then go back to where how we actually got this business started, but I just want you to know that my grandfather did move to that area.
Right.
Had a house built, and it was right next to the railroad tracks.
Okay, that leads me to the next logical step is your father grew up there. You said that. Then how does he end up here with your grandmother? Did they live in Grand Haven?
They moved to, when my grandfather retired from farming, he moved on 7th Street, and he lived on one of the nicest homes on 7th Street, which is no longer there because Beacon Boulevard goes right through the city. But it had four bedrooms, three baths, was three stories high. And then, as I can remember, when I was just a boy, I can remember him having a radio, one of those radios that run with batteries. And WGHN is the only one that I think that I could hear. and it was all static, but even if you'd hear a little, it was so, oh boy, you're overwhelmed with joy because you're hearing something so far away.
Yeah.
But he retired and was, he'd come to our home and sometimes chop wood, and he was a family man. He helped all his children. And so Jacob Rising was his name, and my grandmother's name was Emma, but it was called Emke in Dutch, Emike. And a lot like Jacob, his name being Jacob, it was Jacob in the Dutch language, but they always called him Jacob. And an incident, coincidence too, that my brother was named after my other grandfather, whose name was Louis Teichman. And my name was supposed to be Jacob. And after my other grandfather was deaf, but he kept calling me Jacob, in the Dutch pronunciation. And for many years, and my folks tried to get him to change, but it was always Jacob. Because that was traditional, that you had to be named after the grandfathers. So it passed on. I'll tell them.
Okay, then your parents, what did your dad do?
My father worked in a factory, and we lived on Pennoyer Avenue in the 940 Pennoyer. And we lived there about 3-4 years, then he moved to the farm, which was on Griffin Street. And the farm there was made up of 7 acres of ground, and there were outside toilets. We had a hand pump, and my mother moved from the city where we had everything, all the utilities, and had to start all over from the bottom. It wasn't very nice for her to start as a farm woman because she wasn't a farmer to begin with. But we were blessed because living out there, it seems that the Depression came on, and we had gardens, and these gardens were our relatives that would raise beans and cabbages and corn, they would can it all, so that in the winter they had plenty of vegetables and so on, and carrots they put in sand and barrels and with sand. And then we would kill a hog or some beef, and we would share that with the relatives. So it was really one thing taking care of the other during Depression days.
Okay, then you had some more property too, right?
Oh, there was some more property, 7 acres more. It was down the street, down Griffin Street. Griffin Street was just a dirt road. It was never graveled when we lived there. And there were stumps that you had to go around with our neighbors had horses, and Warber was in the milk business, and he had horses that he used daily to deliver his milk in Grand Haven. So it was pretty primitive. There was nothing that was convenient out there. And this 7 acres of land, which was across from where the new school on Griffin Street is, or the grade school, and we would have to deliver our cows there to this pasture land and during the summer months before school. We'd have to milk the cows, my brother and I, and my dad worked in the factory, so that was our responsibility. And then when the Depression came along, then my father no longer had a job in the Challenge machine shop. He was foreman there. Then we got involved in a wood business. And the wood business was, first we just cut trees down to keep ourselves warm. We had a cook stove and a heating stove in the living room, but we cut more than we needed. So then we sold cords of wood to our neighbors or whoever needed it, because that was the inexpensive way to heat a house. People couldn't afford coal or oil, so a lot of people just burned wood. A lot of times it's green wood. And what happened, it grew out of this, the business. Actually, then my father purchased acres of land, and on this acres we'd cut the smaller trees, and we developed logs, which were good sized logs, and eventually he bought a sawmill. But before cutting this wood, before I should go
yes.
back and
yes,
say
this is a good
we,
story.
We cut the wood by hand. It was with a cross-cut saw, and we did it that way for a few years. But then we were able to purchase an old car. They just the engine with a direct drive shaft to the saw, which we called a buzz saw. And in those days, it was very dangerous because, you know, if someone would get their fingers in there, they could just cut them off. And we did have people that worked for us later on that did have that problem. We had accidents. But my mother always worried about something happening to my brother Louie and myself. And we worked on that saw because it made such a loud noise and it was revved up so fast. And then from there, then we went into this steam engine that was bought. And the lumber was rough lumber, and to keep the steam engine going, you used the slabs of wood. You just kept feeding the boiler, and this made the steam, and the steam drove the belts and the saws. And we went on and did this for a number of years, and we made railroad ties for the Pierre-Marquette Railroad, and to think that we cut the trees down, someone had to cut them down, then go over to the mill and put in the shape of a railroad tie, then hauled into Grand Haven to the Pierre-Marquette Depot, and then four men with a stick in between, they would walk up a ramp like to fill up the car, and that was a job. And the highest price was around 95 cents for the best, and the lowest, there were three grades of tie, railroad ties. The lowest was 65 cents, and then I think 85 and 95. So that's how we got started in the lumber business. We really started, just crept into it, and then what had happened. My father, we furnished a lot of wood for Dornbus Fish House. They were the biggest fish smoking in this part of the country. And we provided them with the wood, oak wood, to smoke these fish. And then during this time, my father was running short with enough wood to supply for Dornbus. Then he went up north and to Nuevo area where there were some mills and to get the oak slabs and wood. And when he was coming back, he was with a neighbor of ours, Fred Broon, and it was raining that day, and a car ahead of him happened to it looked like he was going to the left, and instead, just before they got to him, he turned right in front of him, and being a wet day, the truck slid and jackknifed, and my father was killed at the age of 48. So at this time I was working for Armour & Company as a salesman out of Grand Rapids, and I was going to be married, and my brother was in the Army. So my brother Louis came home from the service. And it was through Ted Bolt, one of our close friends and Sunday school teacher, who helped get him relieved from the service. And he took over and worked for my father, where my father left off, and supported my mother while I went into the Navy, and where I was just about 4 years. So then after I got out of the service, I went to business college in Grand Rapids. And while I was there, and my wife worked at the telephone company, we made some connections for lumber and for insulation and roofing and home products. And that's where we started from scratch to build a lumber company that was on a finished basis. But before this, I did, when I was in high school in 37, 38, I worked for a company by the name of Van Zylen Lumber Company, which was a good lumber company, one of the bigger ones in Grand Haven. There was three lumber companies, one in Chrisman over in Spring Lake, then there's Baker, who's still in business in Grand Haven, Van Zylen Lumber Company, and then my brother and I, we started on the south end of Griffin Street, and that's, but today, Van Zylen is no longer a lumber company. It's been replaced by Myers Market. Chrisman Brothers went out of business, and the only other friendly competitor we have is D. Baker, and we're good friends, and we work together with them whenever they need help or we need, we can count on one another.
Okay, when you worked with that lumber yard, that's where you gained some of the insight into the business too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an interesting experience working there because this Mr. Van, I was an athlete in all the sports, basketball and football, and he would go to all the games because he just loves sports. And when I worked in the office, he said, well, you better go now. It's time that you practice, and playing basketball at that time. And he would go to all the basketball games, and boy, he would root for me. And his wife was also, and his son, Jim Van Zylen, had been, and Fred Denherter from Grand Haven were star players at Michigan State University. They were at their in their day. They're both gone now. They all are. But this lumberyard, I worked in the office and then wherever they needed me. Sometimes it was unloading a car of lumber or whatever it was. Mr. Van would say, well, truck, you clean the bathroom today. Well, they had one of these old toilets that had a supply tank on the wall, and you pulled it by a chain, and it just shot through. Well, after I got done cleaning up the bathroom, which was an awful mess, and then he says, "You dust off the tin can or the paint cans." And after I got done, he says, "What kind of paint did you dust off?" And he was quite a teacher himself. He says, "You know, that's enamel. It was Pittsburgh paint at that time." He says, "Now you should know it was enamel and this and that, because the more you know about paint, you can tell other people." And that happened coincidentally a short time afterwards. I was unloading a car of 2x4s, and after I got it done, which took a couple days, loaded by hand, he came to me. He says, "Now that hemlock there, what was the length of the 2x4?" And I said, "I don't know." He says, "What was the species?" I didn't know anything, it seemed like. He says, "You know, it's an education just even to unload cars and lumber. Other people think it's a job, but really it's a learning process where you could tell me I got heavy on 2x4 tens or this or that, and that helped me to buy the lumber later on." So I learned a great deal from him about the lumber business, and worked in the office and typed invoices and statements and collected, did just everything.
Okay, then when you guys got into you kind of talked about the having the other things to needed to build homes. When was that you started to get into that part of the business?
Well, we started in the lumber business, and we had an old barn on the south end of Griffin Street. My mother owned, and she owned an old house there, and we used the barn to store the supplies that we got from Grand Rapids, and the lumber was put outside. And later on, we rented her house, the old house, which she rented out to someone else, but they vacated so we could use it for an office. And then we stored windows and doors and so on in there. And it was interesting how that it grew until finally the city said we had to move to another location because that was not commercial. So then we bought the land on Jackson Street through the city, and year that was, is in the 50s, early 50s, that we moved to this area. And being in the lumber business, my philosophy was, instead of selling a 2x4, which in those days was 54 cents, and building a garage, maybe cost about $600-$700 at the most, I thought maybe what we should do is prefabricate or nail together the walls of a garage. And then we just nailed the roof rafters together. It wasn't even a truss. It was just by doing this, we turned around and sold packaged garages, and they got to be so successful. I think the first year we sold about 65 garages. And that, in that day and age, they were very popular because the houses that they built after the Second World War, they didn't build garages onto the houses like they do at the present time. And so the cottages, or I mean the garages, got bigger until finally they said, well, can't you build one 24 by 24? And yeah. And then someone says, well, I'd like one 24 by 32, which I know is 768 square feet. And that was a pretty good size. And he says, well, we're going to use it for a cottage. And so we start building cottages and garages, and then it went into housing. And the first houses that we built and fabricated were on Slayton Street, and they're still standing today. And that's been over 40 years ago. And then it just kept growing from houses to duplexes, to apartment houses, condos, and so today the homes is putting out on a unit basis from 1,200 to 1,500 units a year.
Very impressive. Now, your brother, is he still active in the business? And he still lives on your family property, too, from where you guys grew up?
My brother Louis and I, we've been partners all our life. We slept together when we were boys, and we've been in business all this time, and I couldn't have a better brother, a better partner, and his wife played a part in it as well. She, when we started out, she was the office girl. She took the phone calls. My mother did it here before that when we sold wood, but when we got into the retail lumber business, and his wife took down the orders and did the office work, because my brother and I neither like detail work. We just rather work. So it started from us nothing, two farm boys, until finally it's grown into what it is today. And the factory is now located on Hickory. It's moved away from Jackson Street, and the old factory we put into the building center. And we sold the original lumber company, which is next door, which is occupied by Ottawa Electric. And when we built this out here, there was only a rough road, wasn't even graveled, from 7th Street, which Beacon, and we were on the end of the road. I have pictures here showing that, but there was nothing. And today, now there's a four-lane highway going right by the lumber company, joining the factory area in the east end of town. And then we also had the channel. The channel out here is on the north side of the tracks. But we filled in a lot of this property, and incidentally, it happened when they built the school on Green Hill. They had to haul away about 80,000 yards of sand. And the Dykehouse brothers, who were located across the street, we made a deal that they would put as much sand as we needed for 25 cents a yard in place. And so that's how we filled in most of this ground where we're on now, today. So it started, and one year we built a storage house, and the office was in that first building, and then we doubled it the next year, and it continued building until we were in the construction field, prefabrication. Then we got into land development, we got into the real estate, we built apartment houses in Swiss Village, and we developed both North and South Holiday Hills, and there was a number of other subdivisions in Allendale and Country Club Woods and a few other ones that we built around Grand Haven. And so we could supply houses whether they wanted them on a fabricated basis or on a stick method. And we did build 100 houses through our construction company in Muskegon some years ago through an FHA program. And that was feeding the lumber or the prefabrication plant.
And you talk about, I mean, it was you and your brother when you started out and your dad there during the Depression, because it was a necessity that kind of grew into a way to make money. You started out with that few people. How many, estimate now, how many employees you guys have?
Well, I would say the building center, at one time, and we have now sold the building center, but at one time we had about 50 some here and over 100 at our homes, employees.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people are still working. After being in the lumber business 50 years and about 40 some years in the prefabrication or rising the homes, we still have a lot of dedicated people. One truck driver worked for us for 45 years. And we have a lot of others that have worked for us for 20 years, 25 years. And so we've had good people.
Yeah. And that makes a nice statement about you guys, that they must like it here, treat it very well. Is there anything else you want to add about the businesses that you may have forgot? Or there's some other things in the book, and I'm not sure how you guys were involved in them, but like international aid,
okay,
Salvation Army.
All right. I think that in the book I have a picture of our first building,
mm-hmm.
and it shows that Jackson Street just went up to where we built this building. And then that was on the other side.
Did it go back to Griffin? Is that what they
No,
the
Griffin is way over here.
Okay.
That wasn't put in for years later. After my brother and I have been involved in a lot of outside activity, besides just being in the building or lumber business and building and developing, it happened many years ago that I read in the Grand Haven paper the local hospital was in the red, and they were always being subsidized by the city of Grand Haven. And so I went to the administrator and I asked him what could turn this thing around. And he says, well, you know, all our doctors send their patients to Muskegon or Holland or Grand Rapids because we don't have any specialists. He says, if we had some good quarters for specialists and they would come here and fill the hospital would start making money. So our first venture was building a medical center on Robbins Road, which is right across from JSJ, and that was going to be for 11 doctors, but it ended up that shortly after we had it going, starting to build, I found property right behind the hospital, which the Episcopal Church had owned, and Bob Staubler, who was a GP in Grand Haven and one of the doctors, told me about this, and so I thought, well, we just made the medical center on Robbins Road for only 4 doctors, and then start this one behind the hospital, which was called Grand Haven Medical Center. And we built that for 11 doctors, and we owned it for many years, and then later on we sold it to the doctors. And that was as this grew, the specialists, the first specialist came to Grand Haven was Jack Henderson. He was a pediatrician. Then next was Don Sycamore, who was an internist. And then they just kept on coming, the surgeons and these people. So they were filling up our hospital, and the thing changed and became a profitable.
Was that second place you talked about, was that where the Dunewood Center is now?
Yes, that's where the Dunewood's.
Is that part of the same building that you guys built?
They added to it on the south.
Yeah.
The original building is what we put up.
Okay.
And that was actually owned by two doctors and Louis and myself. You know, the four of us. Because the doctors moved in and they were brave enough to go in to invest in this, knowing that there was a future in it. Well, that was one of the things that happened that we were part of, and we were quite proud to be part of it. But then there was also World Vision. They were located on Hickory, and there was 5 acres of ground off from the property that we built. Was owned by the Hoffman Estate at that time, and Ted Bolt was in charge there, and he gave 5 acres of land to International or to World Vision, and then a group of us business people, we got together and decided that we would build some warehouses, and we built the warehouses, and we worked out of there for many years. Before that, they were all around town. They were in little rented stores and that, where they had supplies and whatever clothing or whatever it was. But that ended up in International. Then when World Vision was going to leave, I went to California and asked if we could, a group of us could form a new company, and we formed International Aid. I was chairman of the board until I retired about 3 years ago. But we started out, we only had about, it was, I think the first year we did about $3.5 million. And on today's, they're doing around $45 million. So it's grown considerable. And Jim Franks and then myself and two others were the ones that started. And they said they'd give it to us after 3 years if it showed a profit, or that we could show it was successful. After 3 years, we had $150,000 on reserve, so we got it for a dollar.
That's successful, I think.
So then International Aid was quite a factor. And then we also built our Rising of Homes out on Hickory. Then we built a marina behind the building center, which is on Jackson Street, and there are 60-some slips there. And then in our land developing, we acquired that over a period of years, the acreage, but we formed South Holiday Hills and North Holiday Hills, and we had so many acres there that we finally sold some to Hoffmaster State Park, and then Construction Aggregate also bought some. So after we sold some of it, we were debt-free, and we kept on developing, and that's what it is today. And today, the IPA is putting in some 600 and some units. We have over, in Swiss Village, we have over 160 units of apartments there. And so that has been a success. We went into the real estate business because we employed people to help sell the lots and to sell houses and so on. So we were also...
Well, if you can build the houses and then you can get somebody to sell them, that makes sense.
Right. And that has now been purchased by Gordon Nemoff, who worked for us over 20 years, and we thought it was that he should take over from where we left off.
Now, with International Aid, can you explain a little bit, for people that don't know what they do, what International Aid actually does?
Okay, International Aid ships goods to about over 100 countries. They are food supplies, medical supplies, and these food supplies, first we shipped a lot of corn over there, and then we would take some of the corn. Yeah, here comes my brother Louis. This
Hello,
is Tom. Yeah. Louis, we're
just me,
Louis.
Yeah,
we're just
tell me your life story.
Oh,
family life story.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's see.
The corn.
Yes, Mike.
When we shipped it, we tainted some of it. And the reason we did that, so they use that to plant. And because if you shipped all the corn and they ate it up, they wouldn't have anything left. So they would use this to plant, use a seed, and then they would eventually raise their own corn. But it's easy to say this where we are because corn comes up pretty fast. But in those countries in Africa and Ethiopia, and they don't have the earth and the ground like we have here. And we shipped corn. We shipped a lot of other materials over. Well, we had a good connection with Gerber's Baby Food, and I think we shipped over 70 containers 1 year to Poland. And I had been in Poland 4 times, and I went to some of these. The reason we go to these countries is to make sure that the goods was getting to the people, and. Normally, we would ship to a church or a mission group like SIM, Sudan Interior Missions, it's called. And they were there for 40 years. And so, being there so many years, you could rely on these people. And so we shipped clothing and medical supplies. And now that is one of the parts where we're getting into stronger. We'll ship x-ray machines, we'll ship operating room equipment, and a lot of drugs. The drugs we get from pharmaceutical companies, Johnson & Johnson, Perrigo, down here in Allegan, and Jack Henderson, being a doctor, and he is on the staff there, he travels just about every year to some of these countries, and other ones do too. Wherever we're shipping to, we make sure the goods get sent. And I found that truth. I've been in Ethiopia and been in all Africa, North Africa, South Africa, been Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and China, India. More countries yet, but we would always make sure, because the government always liked to get their fingers in it. They did. They would sell it, and it wouldn't get to the people who would want it to go to. And it's all gifts. We would get the baby food from Gerber's. That's just one example. There were other ones. Camry came with companies that give us goods, so we shipped. But the one year when I was there, they were lacking food over in Poland, and we went to a senior citizen housing, and here we found all this Gerber baby.
So in Poland, you said that you actually found baby food that they were giving to the elderly.
To the older people that were in these homes, like convalescent homes in places like we have in America. And they didn't have enough food produced in the country. This was shared with those places over the winter months for the next season. But now, Poland is in pretty good shape. I don't think we're shipping the international aid is shipping very much to Poland because they're on their feet and they're producing much better than they did. And so it's these other countries, Bosnia and so on, where they're putting in their efforts.
Mm-hmm. Now, did they, correct me if I'm wrong, but does international aid help out sometimes with natural disasters in the United States?
Hurricanes and things like that, where they might need blankets and lumber, we ship lumber from here, plywood and other things. We also ship things down into, let's see, it
It's the island of well, anyway, we ship trusts to an island where Wolf, Tony Wolf, was doing missionary work down there, and so they wanted to build schools, and they sent a block machine, and they made cement blocks, and we sent the truss over there, and when they got there, I stopped over to see it in Lakanav. That's the island of Lakanav, off from Port-au-Prince, and when I got there, I found out instead of putting the truss 2 foot on center, they put 4 foot on center because they didn't have the snow load, and the truss would go just twice as far. They used the schools during the day, and they used them on weekends for churches. And I think that's still going on yet today.
The other one that's on here, is there a connection with the Salvation Army?
Oh, the Salvation Army, yes. That was, I've been on the board for over 25 years. Yeah, 30 years, because it was 22 years ago that one of the board members was Mrs. Lee. And Mrs. Lee was very much interested in the Salvation Army and the future of it. And the old building down on Washington Street, which is a 3-story high building near Harbor.
It's where the pavilion is now. That pavilion food is in the building they were in. The Salvation Army just celebrated their 75th year.
Yeah.
So, and they came down there and they were in front of that building. And I heard them talk about that building, and they had a gym on the 3rd floor, which they were
right. When I was a boy, yeah, we played in that gym. And so the Salvation Army was a place for recreation, and they used it because there weren't any other gyms at that time that the kids could use. The schools were closed on Saturday. How this started, I was on the board, and they had talked for years and years about moving the Salvation Army to a new location, but they always wanted to put it in an area that were maybe substandard housing or something, you know. But Grand Haven didn't have a lot of substandard houses. But this one woman, Mrs. Lee, came up to my office one day and she says, "I wish you would do something to help build a new building." And I says, "Well, we have to have a location." And she says, "Well, they've been fighting about that for years and years. No one can come to an agreement where it should be." She says, "But if you help, maybe we can get this job done." So while she was in my office, I had the engineering department next door. I asked her to pull a plan of a little church that we had built. And I said, "Put the Salvation Army shield on the front of it." So while we were talking about this, and she was telling me how before anything happened to her, she was anxious that something would be done, he came in with a plan, and deep tears came to her eyes. She says, "I can't believe it. How'd you do it?" Well, I says that we had built this church, and I just... So we went back and asked the Salvation Army people whether they would go along with this type of a building. And they came back with a negative answer, saying no, they wouldn't go along, but they didn't want it to look like a church. So I says, "Well, we can fix that up." So I just had our engineering department put a mansard roof on, this flat roof.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed it to them. Fine. And so 21 years ago, there was a committee of... 3 on the building committee, and Dave Clausen, who we appointed to raise the money, and he went around to the factories, all corporations, and within about 2 or 3 weeks after we had plans and we had flip charts, we raised $210,000, which was a good, that was a lot of money at one time. So a lot of the people in the community were always backing the Salvation Army. So we, then we had to buy this property, and the property was quite an ordeal. First of all, to get, it's on Dispelder Street, there was a barn in the back, and it was called the Schaefer Park farm, and it wasn't very big, but he had horses, and he had a little house in front of it, but he had passed away, but it was still there. So we, I approached those people, I said, would you like to sell your house? And they said, no, I don't think so, it was in the winter. Well, I said, if you got the right price, would you consider it? And so they said, well, we would. So I came up with a figure, and they says, yeah, I think we would go along, because they could make enough money where they could put it down on another one. And so I wrote on a piece of paper, the purchase of this house is so many dollars, and I gave them a $100 bill, and I wrote out a check, personal check, and gave it to them. Well, when I went back to the Army, boy, they didn't like that at all, because they wanted to say yes and no about it. Well, the idea is, when the iron's hot, you got to do it. Well, then there were three other houses alongside there, and I went to each one of those and asked if they would sell, and I got them to go along with it. But after a while, the last one or two, the first one we got with no problem at all. The next two, they wavered on it so long that the Salvation Army did not approve these two houses being purchased. And the fellow says, if you don't buy them within the next few days, then we're going to up the price. So another fellow and I, Al Cook and myself, we each bought one of those houses and held it until they approved it. But then we got started on the building, and we put up the first part, and we still had $67,000 left. And so 2 years later, we built on an addition on the south side of it. But it's been well built. 21 years ago, it was built, and everything is in very good shape. The Salvation Army is celebrating its 75th birthday in Grand Haven this year. So we're real pleased with that type of operation and the people who run it.
Now, the people that were kind of the ones that weren't going along with the area or buying the houses, did they change once they saw the new building? Or was it a slow process? Or
they were just the homeowners. It wasn't...
Right. Okay, well, I thought some of the Salvation Army you said were...
They
didn't want that
okay,
area, or did they like that area?
Yeah. What happened, the Salvation Army is like being in the service. It's got to go from one department to another. Well, it had to go to Grand Rapids, and Grand Rapids, local area, then it goes to the central area, and then it goes to Chicago. And by the time this passed through all these different groups, it took months to get anything done. And we weren't accustomed. We wanted to get this thing up. And so they resented some of the things we did, but they gradually took a liking to what we did. And to know we had all the money before we started. And I was given the highest award that the Salvation Army can give to anybody. And it's called the Others. And there's only two people in Grand Haven got one. And there's mine right there.
Yeah, impressive.
For being the steerhead to build the...
Well, that answers my question. They obviously, once it was built, they had no more problem.
No more problem. Yeah. We're doing little things like fixing up the yard, or we want to keep in the shrubbery. We're doing that right now. And we want to keep the building up, so it's good for another 50 years. Anything more on Salvation Army?
I can't think of anything. I don't know if we missed anything that you want to mention, other than I know in the book you've got big, large pictures of your own and your brother's families.
Yeah, my family,
I have 15 grandchildren. I had 3 children, 15 grandchildren. And at the present time, I have 15 grandchildren. One is graduated from Dartmouth. 2 years ago, she's married, and I got 7 in 7 different colleges in the state of Michigan. In the states. I should say Central, State, and Western. Then they go down to Georgia and Florida and Nashville and Arizona. So that our family's growing up pretty fast. My brother's got with grandchildren and great-grandchildren, I think he's got 14. And we also we have a girl that made her home with us from Thailand for 8 years. She was lived with us and went through high school and went through Michigan State College. And she married a young man who was an engineer and a professor now in Thailand. He graduated from Michigan State College. They have 2 children. One boy is an orthodontist, and the girl is going to be a radiologist of this group. But it's interesting to watch these kids grow up, and we had some fine times together. We have each Sunday we have from 8 to 10 people for dinner. Each family is invited. Each have their turn, and they bring their friends, and our dinners last anywhere from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, at least 2 hours. We sing, we pray, we read, we blow bubbles, have contests, and win prizes, and it's been going on now for 20 years or so.
And now your son, Charles III, is in the business now, right?
Yes. He and his cousin John are purchasing the building center, and they also purchased the marina, and they are doing a good job of running the company. And Louie and I, we have our offices here, and my brother's with Habitat and does a great job with Habitat. He spearheaded that, and I think they have 19 houses, and 3 are in the process of being finished now. And incidentally, his age is 80. Mine's 76, but he's still going strong, and he doesn't stay away from the office much more than a month a year. Then he goes down to Florida, where I go for 5 months. But it's been one of the things that made the success of our business is our wives. You know, if you're partners, I was told that years ago by the banker, he says, you know, the first five years in a partnership, you'll lose about 50%. He says, then 10 years, you'll lose another 25%. And by the time 20 years rolls along, if you have 5% are still partners, and that would be unusual. But here we've been 50 years, and I couldn't find a better partner. His wife and my wife have always been never been part of the business as such, making decisions. And there's never been any feeling that one is getting a better deal than the other. So now we're passing it on to the next generation, and we're passing on some apartment houses to our daughters and land and that, and we hope that they in turn continue to do some of the things that we've done in the past 50 years.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time, and I think that will close our interview.